Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig, it's 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And today, I'm so excited. I've spoken to a lot of legends on this channel, but who I have with me today is probably the biggest legend in magic. This is a gentleman who has been there, bought the t-shirt several times over. He's responsible for more incredible best-selling magic than anyone I know, and he's just lit up the magic community again by bringing out what I think is one of the best books I've read in the last year. We'll talk about that more a little bit later on. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Ben Harris. How are you doing, Ben? You okay?
Mate, I am brilliant. Thank you. Wow, what an intro.
True.
That's the danger of these sort of programs, man. It's so embarrassing initially for the recipient of all the praise, but I really appreciate it. Thank you. I mean, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time, mate. Remember this. Boom.
I do.
X-ray.
I do. I love
2000.
I've never been more fooled in my life.
2010, and look at what's happened to your career since then, man. It's like, boom.
I know. We've gone on, haven't we? But honestly,
we have grown.
I've been a big fan of yours for such a long time, and I've interviewed a lot of people on this channel. Some of them, their career, I don't really know much about, but I know so much about the magic that you've created and you've released. I've owned most of it. I've performed pretty much all of it, and I'm so glad to have you on the channel, just so we can talk about everything that you've done and your creative process, because, it's incredible. And there might be some people watching this that are newer into magic that might not be aware of everything that you've done. So I'm hoping that we can touch on everything, if that's okay, Ben.
Yeah, it's going to be a long interview. But yeah, thank you. It's been 40 years that I've been doing this sort of in one way or another. I tend to disappear for, you know, 5 or 10 year blocks of time just to refresh. So I'm easy to forget about.
I don't think you are.
Seriously.
Well, let's start at the very beginning for people who maybe aren't aware of your body of work and who you are. Let's talk about your origin story first. From my point of view, it feels like you've been in magic forever, but there must be a time when did you get into magic, Ben? How did that whole thing happen?
Well, as a child, I was just interested. I remember being maybe 10, 11, 12 and watching the Harry Houdini film with Tony Curtis, Janet Leigh, with the family. And I disappeared into my room, into my bedroom, and for half an hour later came back with a mocked up set of multiple billiard balls made out of ping pong balls, a milk pitcher. It was just obvious to me how these things worked, and I was just fascinated. And to then actually go out and perform these two tricks, you know, for the family, just reinforced it all. And I'd take cereal boxes, makeup tricks. It's just always been in my blood. It's what I love to do. And I think you need to do what you love to do if you're going to do it well. It has to have passion. Well, yeah, I mean, I disappear from time to time because you just become physically and mentally exhausted from the work, from the travel, from the writing, from the editorial deadlines, from chasing royalties. So you just disappear and you come back when you're grasped by that passion again. You know, it has to pull you back in.
Well, when you got into magic, did you want to be a creator or did you want to be a performer? Because we obviously we know you as a creator. Did that happen very early on, or were you focused on performing and then creating happened later?
Well, right from the from 1982, I started performing professionally in restaurants, which was a very new thing back in that time period. And I just needed material that was my own. I'd been brought up in all of the classic books. I'd studied them all. I mean, Paul Harris is an absolute hero. Daryl, Michael Ammar, all of these people, Jay Sankey. But in order to reflect who you are, you need, I think, to perform your own material because it should be your magic. So it was just a natural evolution. And I've just always been creative with magic, so it was very easy for me. And it is very easy nowadays, but you learn the steps of what it takes. You either create from the top down or the bottom up, depending upon what you want to achieve. But it takes quite a while, I think, to actually master the processes that you have to go through in order for it to be seamless, easy, and joyful. Because if it's not joyful, don't do it.
That's brilliant advice. That's brilliant advice. You know, you've published and created so much magic. I speak to so many people that have come into magic in the last 5-10 years that want to be creators. They want to make a name for themselves as a creator of magic and publishing magic. As somebody that's created and published so much magic over the years, is there any advice that you can give?
Yeah, most definitely. It has to work in the real world. You have to... It has to become second nature to you. That comes only from going out and doing it over and over again, refining it. Until you've spent a year or two with it, working it in the real world, I don't think it deserves to be published because it shouldn't be the purchasers of your effect or your book that have to do the groundwork. I mean, it should be done for them. The kinks should be worked out. And you see a plethora of magic released nowadays, but it's always been this way. That's just, they're just one trick ponies and they're out there just to make a quick buck. And that's not how the art of magic progresses. It keeps it alive. It keeps everybody turning over. It keeps everybody on their toes. But it really should be thoroughly worked through first. That's so important.
That's really good advice. And in terms of creating magic and releasing magic, I might be wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you've probably created the most ripped off magic trick of all time, because you created Cosmosis, which is the original floating match. And since then, It's been copied a million different ways. I would be willing to bet that that's probably the most ripped off trick of all time.
Most definitely that is the case. It was ripped off within a month of it originally being released by an Austrian firm. An American importer was caught importing 1,000 units. This is within a month of the trick coming out. This is 1986. I was very angry for many, many, many years. I'm not angry anymore because it has been ripped off into classicdom. It is now a classic, and that may not have happened if it hadn't have been stolen from me. But it also brought to light some wonderful, wonderful people in magic. Take Mark Murphy from Murphy's Magic. They were selling, 1,000 ripped off pieces to every 100 pieces of the original. This is back in the early 1990s. Mark rang me up and said, "Ben, I'm making good money selling the ripoffs, but I feel so bad. This is your trick. How about I cut you in on a deal? And I pay you for every ripoff I sell." Now, boom, to this day, I mean, last month I received a royalty check from Murphy's Magic because of that deal with Mark. And what a lovely thing to do.
He didn't have to do that. It's not like you
he
rung him up.
He didn't have to do it. No, that's, yeah, but that's, so there are some lovely people out there that do care. You might not think they care because they're behind big corporations or whatever, but I mean, he cared. And that was very good for Cosmosis and the rip-off salespeople as well, who are now out of business. So anyway, that's all beside the point.
Well, is there anything that we can do as creatives to stop people from ripping off our magic? Because, you know, it does put people off creating. It does. Some I've heard of many creators that have just stopped creating because they're sick and tired of creating something, and then within weeks having it. John Cornelius is the perfect example. I mean, there's a gentleman who
got
completely
another one. Steve Dushek, Mr. Yep. Wonderbar. I mean, my God, that man was a tour de force, the loveliest guy in the world, a very dear friend. And he basically just retreated from the market because he could not compete with the ripoffs. And that's so sad because it's just bad for everybody. You're not going to get any more new ideas from Steve at the time because why? It's just going to be stolen. Yeah. And it was blatant. Well, it's blatant with the floating match. You can Google floating match and there are a million, you know, $2 versions you can buy from little shops everywhere. There's nothing you can do about it except, there really is nothing you can do about it. You just have to put it out there. Whatever happens, happens, and you move on. As my dad says, what is. And sometimes that's the case. Doesn't make you happy.
No.
But I don't lose sleep over that particular instance anymore. But I mean, the instant ripping off of books as, scanning them and putting them up as e-books without the author's permission. I mean, that's absolutely disgusting.
It really is. It really is.
Yeah, it is. But you know, a lot of these places are in China. I mean, what can you do about it?
Nothing.
Yep.
No, that's the thing. That's the thing. Just hope.
So, you chin up, move on, and you just leave everybody in your wake. That's all you can do.
Again, great advice. Great advice. What would you say, Ben? What would you say was the trick that kind of put you on the map within the industry, put you up there? You know, you mentioned Michael Amar, you mentioned Daryl, yeah. You mentioned Jay Sankey, Paul Harris. For me, you're at that level with the legends of magic. What was it that put you at that level when you first started creating? Was it Cosmosis? Was there a particular product that you can point to that you went, you know what? This is the one that's kind of cemented my name within the industry.
Yeah. Well, firstly, you can't put me on the same pedestal as those guys, okay? I refuse to accept that. They are my heroes. I stand on their shoulders to whatever degree I stand on their shoulders, and I love doing that. I miss Daryl very much, a lovely guy. Mm-hmm. What was your question again, dude? I got distracted there.
Is there a particular trick that kind of...
Cosmosis for sure, because of the controversy. Controversy is very good in magic. Ask Uri Geller. His entire career, boom, 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 is on about controversy and being consistent with that. The epic flight, the trick with the two brass keys and the marking pen that used the whiteboard principle in a very clever way that hadn't been used before. Jeff Busby sold maybe 10,000 of those. It was just absolutely massive. It was huge. The book Gellerism Revealed was very important as well. Very important because it was the first book of the time period that dealt with the methods physically one after the other. Here's how you do it. Here's really nice ways of replicating what Uri Geller has done. Yeah, those three things, Epic Flight, Cosmosis, and Gellerism Revealed, for sure.
Wow. Wow.
And they're so different to one another as well. I like exploring different areas because I get bored and then will have to leave unless I find something that excites me.
Well, that's the other question I was going to ask, because a lot of creators, they almost, I'm not saying this is wrong, but they focus on one particular area. And, you know, we talk about just a couple of, you know, the perfect example is the new book that we're going to be talking about later on that talks about the Svengali principle that you've just released with Vanishing Ink. You know, parity is this incredible, almost cerebral tour de force where, you know, you're dealing with odds and the impossibility of things. And then you look at something like the Chimera presentation, where you've got like multiple color changes built in. Just in that one book, you've got mentalism, you've got incredible visual sleight of hand, and you've got all of these elements going into one book. And all of your products you released over the years, you can't pin yourself down to one genre. Was that done on purpose? Well,
No, it's not done on purpose. I don't actually seek these things out. I just try to keep myself amused. That happened, of course, with Robert Neal's trapdoor card with the Machinations book. I became fascinated with that and decided to like strip it down to its basics and then ask the question, what else could be done with this? And it's the same with the new book, with the Svengali deck. You know, we've had it since 1905, but we've used it pretty much in the same way since then. Sure, we've made little variations here and there, but I don't think until recently anybody had asked the question, is a Svengali deck still a Svengali deck if you throw away the 26 force cards? Because 26 force cards, that's an inherent part. But what happens if you disregard those, throw them away? What's left? Where can we go from there? And that's where it all started. You just strip something down to the basics. With the Svengali deck, that's the 26 regular cards, 26 short duplicates. And I then stripped in my mind the backs and the faces from them. So I just had these blank slabs. And that's the starting point, because it became obvious that there were actually all of these extra spaces hidden in there that we just skimmed over before, because they were the backs that had to be there, or they were the regular faces that had to be there. Well, no, they didn't have to be there at all. So it's just me trying to keep myself amused. And every now and then you'd strike something that is really, really valuable.
Wow. And where, I suppose, one question I have for you, which is something that a lot of creators struggle with, where do you find the inspiration? Because I think one of the hardest parts of creativity is being inspired in the first place, finding that methods, you know, you can come up with a million methods to most tricks, but it's having that inspiration. And I've seen you release tricks that are very unique in terms of effects, but I've also seen you take on a particular thing, like the Svengali principle, and saying, well, this is the way it's been done for 100 years. Now, what else can I do with it? How can I look at it outside the box? Where do you get your inspiration from when you're creating?
Firstly, how is the sound? Because my headphones have dropped out.
I can hear you. It's still clear. Crystal clear. It's absolutely fine.
So you're not. Your voice isn't echoing here, or?
Nope, not at all. I can hear you perfectly well.
Excellent. Okay, so where do I get the inspiration? Again, just trying not to be bored. Every day of my life. I mean, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm in bed at midnight. That's my average day. I consider myself a writer by trade now, so I have to be sitting down, writing, turning out words, whether it be in magic or whether it be in other genres, consistently. I mean, as you know, you have to produce a certain amount of words if you're going to be viable as a writer. It's a very difficult thing to do. So you have to find things to write about. things that, as Stephen King said, they have to be things that you're interested in. You know what I'm saying? Maybe you're interested in plumbing, but you know that's not going to make a very interesting book. But how about a plumber on Spaceship Extra exploring the outer solar system? Well, hey, there's a plot. You know what I'm saying? But it all comes about not deliberately trying to create new magic. There's enough magic. I have enough magic. I don't need any more magic. I don't need to create any more magic, but you just go where the inspiration leads you. But you have to keep your eyes open, your mind open. You have to notice things. I mean, for instance, Cosmosis, the floating match. I wanted to create a close-up levitation that controlled the ends of thread, because thread work can be fussy. I mean, where does that end go? Where does that end go? What happens if it breaks? Well, Cosmosis takes away the ends of the thread. You don't have to worry about it anymore. It also means you don't have the problem of wobble. Okay? Normally things, you know, the levitation, if there's a hanging thread, you've got a wobble. You can see it. You try and disguise it with a spin, which to me just makes it obvious anyway. But the multiple threads of Cosmosis, no end fiddly problems, no wobble. And it's just so important. You just keep pushing. You just keep pushing. And that came out of the solution. That trick came out of seeing a program on architecture on television. I was sitting with my sister, 1985 this would have been, and there was a program of architecture on television, and it showed these beautiful bridges, these lovely extension bridges passing across rivers, and the architecture of them, the structure of them, how the support was built in was absolutely fascinating and provided the solution. I went to my room, stripped some threads out of a stocking, super glued them to the end of the card, and within half an hour, it's like, hey, sis, check this out. What do you think? And boom, there it was. Of course, you know, all that hand that's come after that in this particular instance. It's like, how do you put the match on the card and flex it without anything happening? That's a very, very important disconnect, very important part of the effect. See, I'm babbling here. Tell me to stop if you like.
No, you're not. This is fascinating, man. Fascinating.
But see, the interesting thing is the Cosmosis book ran for 24 A4 pages of detail. You buy the rip-off, you get, if you're lucky, one A4 page of basic information. So all the subtleties that make it powerful are gone. I mean, I attended a convention in America in 1986 and 1987 and fooled personally hundreds of magicians with it, because again, this is a detail in the manuscript, the real manuscript. You can do this with a signed card. The spectator signs his name on the back of the card. The match floats off their signature. I mean, it's totally impossible. They can take the card at the end as a souvenir. This is all in the original manuscript. I remember performing it for Max Maven the first time I met him. Dear Max. And he loved it. I still have the card somewhere with his signature on it.
That's great.
And the little broken bits of thread at the end.
That's amazing. So let's talk about one of my favorite tricks, or a couple of my favorite, because you've got so many. But one thing that you brought out many years ago, which I love, is, do you remember, of course you're going to remember it, Exit 51?
Yes, yep.
Like that,
I used to do that all of the time. Lovely trick.
It's one of my favorite tricks to perform. I just think it's amazing. Where did you get the inspiration for Exit 51?
Paul Harris's original Vanishing Deck.
That's what I thought. Right, okay.
Yeah, it was just another way of making the same gimmick in a way, you know what I mean? But it allowed a quick shuffle cutting sequence, which the original did. But Paul Harris. See, there you go. So that, I mean, Paul Harris influenced that completely. And I mean, it's fully credited, I'm sure, in the manuscript. I mean, Paul and I are good buddies. It's Paul's completely.
So how important, if somebody wants to be a creator, how important is it to be well-read. I mean, you're sitting there in front of a very impressive library and a very impressive collection of books, some of which I've never read. And
this is so that I keep myself moving forward, new stuff. I mean, there's not just magic books, there are books here on science, pseudoscience, whole section of Carl Sagan's books. I mean, we live in a very, very magical universe. And I think you see, like in the Symmetry of Parry book, I sort of touched on some of these things. There's a lot of magic out there in the universe. What we do as magicians of, in many instances, pales in regard to the magic of the universe. But that's no reason to not to try and be as magical as you can, you know what I'm saying? But we have, you know, Mother Nature is a hell of a wizardess to live up.
And when you're creating magic, Ben, do you you talked about one of the most important things is that the magic you create needs to be workable in the real world.
Yes.
Do you go out and work everything in? Let's say you've come up with an incredible trick. What's the process you go to in terms of testing and refining it from the point where you think you've got it right to the point where you go, you know what, this is now releasable. I can now offer this as a product.
Well, I perform, semi-regularly. I mean, not as often as I used to. I don't have the time because, as I say, writing is where my heart is at the moment. But it's about going out and testing. Firstly, obviously, it's the wife. It's like, hey, sweetie, check this out. What do you think? And if she falls down, half dead on the floor, it's like, my God, then, it's worth sort of taking, because Diane and I have been together for 40 years. So wow. She knows me better than anybody, so that's the first test. That's the litmus test. And then it's just, friends and acquaintances, day-to-day business meetings, etc. And semi-regular gigs, corporate stuff, weddings, etc., product releases. They're things that really interest me because you get a chance to actually customize a client's product using your own magic or applying your ideas to their product, and they always love that. And you get to charge them more money because it's become an integral thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. I want to ask you about one more of your products, because most creators will create mentalism or close-up magic or cards or coins. You created what I think is probably the most off-the-wall magic trick I've ever seen. And I remember being aware of this when someone performed it on me. And it was the closest thing I'd ever seen to real magic at the time, which is, I think you probably know where I'm going with this, hole in the head, which from memory had ideas from Michael Weber and Paul Harris in it as well, who are two obvious legends. Like, for people that aren't aware, this is not like any trick you've seen before, and it's very situational in terms of when you can do it, but when you get the right place at the right time, this is miracle status. Like, I became aware of it having someone perform it on me, and I had no idea. Like, I was just blown. I was floored. Like, completely flawed. Can you talk a bit about that, because that's the most crazy. How would you even come up with that? Like, you know what, I'm gonna do this. Could you describe what the effect is and how you came up with that, because it's mad, frankly. It's mad.
Well, thank you for coming at it from such a positive angle, because I don't know whether you remember, but that trick, that effect, that concept was, I was crucified over that. For whatever reason, I think that everybody from the marketing side of magic just built it up way too big, way too big for its situational aspect. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you can't just do it anywhere and everywhere. And I think a lot of people, it was implied that maybe you could
anyway, a lot of flack. I would rather forget about it from a product point of view. However, from an effect point of view, you are right. It is profound. It's the right time, the right situation. It is amazing. And basically, you are opening a proverbial hole in your head and allowing the sun, which is behind you, to shine through and burn a hole in your shadow. And it's guru stuff, if you like. Right time, right place. Absolute miracle stuff. However, as I say, the industry panned. I mean, I didn't go back to the Magic Cafe for like 12 months after the controversy. It just wasn't worth the grief. But hey, it's just one of those things. You cannot get everything perfect, cannot be right all of the time. Not everything you put out there is going to be well received. People are going to be scathing, but as I said before, chin up, boom, straight ahead, let them fall behind you in the wake, because all you can do is be honest to yourself. It's as simple as that. This is my best shot. This is my best effort. I'm sorry if you disapprove, but you're not going to stop me. I'll give it another go.
I think it was like I said, the only thing I can say about it is right time, right place.
Yeah.
You can't do anything stronger than that. There's nothing you can do. It's a genuine reputation maker if you're in the right time.
Guru material. It really is. And there aren't a lot of things that are like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's profound in its own way. I mean, which is pretty good for a magic trick, to be profound or to evoke profound feelings or feelings of genuine wonder. This is one of Uri Geller's great secrets. He invokes great wonder. It doesn't matter whether he's really psychic or a fake. It doesn't matter. And David Burgess in the new book coming out about Uri Geller. David Burgess confirms this. It doesn't matter whether it's real or not. It's the effect that counts. Peter Turner in the book basically says, hey, Uri gave us permission to wonder. And it's true. Yeah. That's basically what it is. And Uri, by being consistent to his story and his theme, whether you love him or hate him, it doesn't matter. He's consistent. And my God, I mean, 14 front page news stories in the United Kingdom over the last 18 months. I mean, boom, who does that?
He certainly knows how to keep himself in the public eye.
Well, and there you go. And as Uri, I've worked with Uri on this new book for like 18 months. And one of the things, which is very interesting, because Uri and I used to be great enemies. There's classic footage of us at each other's throats from back in 1986, I believe. Uri's consistency is important. And what he keeps reminding me, he says, Ben, do not be afraid of being controversial. Make sure they spell your name correctly, which is a classic. We've all heard that one before. And most importantly, Ben, remember, this is the entertainment industry. Now, that tells you all you need to know. This is the entertainment industry. So that puts your disclaimers and your is he real or is he not, or he's a fake or he's real or it's just a trick. It puts it all in perspective. This is the entertainment industry. And I mean, hey, you have, you know, amazing plots in movies that are just beyond science. Well, how is that different to the claim that a spoon can be bent sideways? Really isn't. It's the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's just such an important lesson for magicians to learn, for us all to understand. This is the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
Anything goes, so long as it's moral and so long as nobody's getting hurt. Basically, anything goes.
Yeah, I completely agree with you 100%. And you mentioned that, I have a couple of other questions, but you mentioned there the words new book and Uri Geller. So is there a new book coming from you, Ben, about Uri Geller?
Yeah, very exciting news. Probably the end of February, first week of March, Bendith Like Geller comes out from Vanishing Ink. A massive book, 244 pages, the same format as Machination, so it's a nice big book, 244 pages, full colour, dozens and dozens of previously unpublished photographs, over 100 technical illustrations from Eva Elizalde, teaching all of the classic methods that have been spread out in different books and magazines for the last 50 years. They all come together. The entire controversy comes together. Uri has signed off on the book, so that tells you that this is an important book. This is the future reference of metal bending. It's the future. If you want to learn metal bending, just get this book. It's worth it just for the bibliography. 2 years worth of work, and I can't wait for it to come out. Man.
Wow. So this is going to be a retrospect on Uri's career as well as a traditional style magic book teaching the bends and the techniques that are used to,
What it is a celebration. It is a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the spoon bend. November 23, 1973 was the first time the world had ever seen a bent spoon, a bent key, or a bent fork. And that was the David Dimbleby talking show. So basically, prior to that date, my friend, a bent spoon or a bent key was nothing but a bloody nuisance. The spoon couldn't get food to your mouth, the key wouldn't open the front door. After the Dimbleby broadcast, November 1973, all of a sudden, a bent spoon was a magical object. A bent key was a magical object, and Uri Geller was an A-lister, and his career took off from there. Magicians wanted to replicate the effect. I mean, why not? It's a stunning effect, and it has all of the things we like about good close-up magic. It happens in the spectator's hand. It happens with their object. They get a great souvenir to take home. They are participating. It ticks all of the boxes. No wonder it's become a classic, and no wonder that 50 years later, a bent spoon, a bent key, nowadays more often a bent coin, still evokes wonder. The interesting thing, though, is over those 50 years, the methods have evolved. And now, by looking back from the tail end, if you like, looking back, we actually see how the evolution has panned out step by step. And it's absolutely beautiful. This led to this, led to this, led to this. But it's all been separated out across magazines and books over the last 50 years. Now it's all under one cover, and it is a celebration. My first book on metal bending, Gellerism Revealed, 1986, published by Mickey Hades, who would not resell me back the rights, that let it go out of print. I wanted the rights back. They don't want to even talk about it. So, young authors and creators out there, here's a tip. Always have an exit clause in your contract. So if your publisher fails to uphold their promise to keep this in print in forever, can't say that word, if they fail, then you can rightfully pull out and then go somewhere else. But anyway, that first book, it was a negative. I look back and it was a negative book. It was a book full of anger because of the controversy at the time. This book, all these decades later, is the exact opposite. It is a celebration because what we have, irrespective of Geller being real or not, it doesn't matter. What we have is one of the most amazing genres in magic and something that is still relevant to this day. And it's just a bend in a piece of metal. So, boom, that tells you how important the presentation is. Yeah, and consistency.
Wow.
This book is this dude. The book is just beautiful. I designed it to look beautiful because metal bending looks beautiful.
Yeah.
So wow, that's very exciting. Yeah, just around the corner.
That must have taken a long time to write.
Very difficult. Yes, 2 years worth of writing and a lot of research and help from dozens and dozens and dozens of people. There are eight essays, eight huge essays in the book. Peter Turner, David Berglas, Steve Shuffton, Pablo Amira, Richard Bush, on and on and on. Because metal bending has meant so much to them. And they have a lot of important things to add to the story as to why it is still relevant today. But the important thing is the book is an absolute celebration. You know, anybody in 50 years' time, if you look at this book, you're not going to see the nastiness. You are going to see a joyful exposition of one of the most beautiful, magical concepts ever, in my opinion. It creates wonder, and that's beautiful. If it makes you consider the possibilities of breaking the laws of physics, just considering them. I mean, you can then pull out Occam's razor and cut it all down if you want. It doesn't matter, but just go there briefly. Yeah, it's just magical stuff, and this is why it's still relevant. Even though, I mean, it's not performed in the same way it used to be. Metal bending used to be a long, protracted, thought out, do you feel it getting warm? Do you feel it bending? Blah, 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 blah. Whereas nowadays, it's whack, 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 whack. There's a beautiful souvenir for you to take home. So it's like it's changed from the actual bending to creating an impossible object. It's just one of the paths the evolution has taken. It's a fascinating story. And of course, we're using bending coins nowadays because keys are becoming rarer and rarer as they're replaced with PIN codes, pass cards, etc. So now we're bending coins. Makes perfect sense. I mean, all you need, and it's so easy too, you just cross over. If you're a magician, you know some coin slots. Otherwise, you're not a magician. You've got to know the face. Well, instead of a copper and silver, I mean, you just, you know, you switch in a bent coin. Same slot, you already know it, but now you've got an entirely new effect.
That's great.
What happens when the world gets to when we become a cashless society? What is the end?
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll probably still have forks, right? We'll probably still have forks.
Yeah, most definitely.
I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. There's always going to be something. Yeah. Wow. Wow. And let me ask you a question. You mentioned right at the beginning of this interview that you like to go away for periods of time.
Yep.
And that's to recharge and rejuvenate. Are these planned absences or, you know, so for example, you've obviously just spent a long time writing Symmetry and Parity. That's come out a couple of months ago. I know that volume 2 is coming out any day now. Then you've got Bend It Like Geller. That's three books in essence that have taken a long time to write. Yes. Are you at a point now where you're like, you know what, I'm going to take a few years off, or do you have other plans? Like, what, how do you decide when you need to take a step back and then come forward into the limelight again?
Life decides for me. I mean, at the moment, there's three new books that I'm halfway through writing. They're all contracted, so it's a matter of finishing them.
Wow.
After that, but they're different genres. They're not all magic. Okay, so this is one of the things I do. I might, okay, so we've had Symmetry and Parity, Bend It Like Geller, and as you mentioned, the second Symmetry and Parity book, which will be an e-book, and we'll get to that in a second. The other books, three that I still owe my publishers, one of them is a magic book, two of them are not magic at all. So that's one of the ways I get away. I can get away from magic by deciding, hey, I'm going to spend the next 18 months fulfilling these book deals. That will give me the refreshment I need. Well, it's like writing. I mean, you know yourself, once you finish the piece of work, you put it aside for a week, a month, 6 months, whatever. Then you come back And as Stephen King says, you kill your darlings. I mean, the little clever things that you thought were just so clever at the time, which now are like, a little bit dodgy. I mean, they go, you got to kill your darling. But they don't become obvious until you've gone away and come back. I think that's very, very important. So sometimes it's only an 18 month, 2 year sort of break, but sometimes that will extend because something else will have attracted my attention. Now, I'm only right to come back to magic when something in magic attracts my attention and pulls me away from everything else. Which sounds overdramatic. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I mean, that's just, it's got to be that strong. Otherwise, I'm not going to be passionate about it. I don't want a casual look. I don't want to write about it casually. I want to give it everything I've got because that's what I do. And if you're not going to give it everything that you've got, then maybe you should be doing something else or taking that break. So maybe if I'm finding I'm not, you know, if something's dragging or I'm not giving it everything I've got, that's one of the reasons. But I'll take a break. That break could just be a month in the library, just doing nothing except researching a string of something, you know, through a whole lot of history. But I mean, it's a distraction. You got to keep yourself amused.
Yeah, you have. Wow.
Just for yourself. You know, if you keep yourself amused and vibrant and alive and full of ideas that are stimulating you, they stimulate people around you just through your own excitement.
And what do you prefer? Do you prefer writing magic or non-magic books?
Both of them equally.
Wow.
No, it's basically non-fiction. Magic books are pretty much non-fiction, I mean, to an extent. Well, they are. It's very hard to place fiction. Nobody wants to look at any new fiction. It's considered too much of a risk by publishers. You need an agent that just deals with fiction. I have an agent that deals with non-fiction, but a non-fiction agent doesn't deal with fiction. That's another story. So I stick with the non-fiction because, you know, I'm known in a couple of the genres now, so that makes it easy. So long as your book sells well, then it's fairly easy to get another contract. Because it's like the publisher, well, hey, he sold well, give him another shot, you know?
That's great. And on the subject of having a publisher, one question I get asked on the channel a lot is how you, again, going back to creating magic, how do you bring it to market? And a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to publish it myself. I'm going to self-publish. And then a lot of other people say, oh, I'm going to go through a Murphy's or a Vanishing Ink or a Penguin Magic or whatever it is. You have a big name in the industry. You've written so many successful books. Is there a reason that you rarely self-publish these big books and you go through a production company? What advice would you give people who are wanting to write a book? They think they've got a book in them. They think it'd be good. They want to write it or they want to publish like a large project that's written or whatever it may be. What advice would you give people as bringing it to market and self-publishing versus going through a company?
Well, I mean, I self-published for decades. It's great, it's wonderful. You keep control of things exactly the way you want them to be. You can decide how much money you want to throw at your project. But the big books nowadays, it costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of money. I cannot tell you how much money was thrown at Symmetry and Parity. Those guys went all out. You've got the book, you've got the decks of cards, the card case, the slip case. I mean, these are all produced in different countries and then brought together. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's hard enough being a good creator. It's hard enough being a good writer or trying to be good at these things. Creating while it can become easy and routine, you still have to do it well. Writing is never easy. I mean, to write clearly is quite difficult. I think you get better or you do it. But the point is, it's hard enough being a writer. I can't be a writer and a publisher. I trust that the publisher has certain skills and knowledge about distribution, publicity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that I don't have. This is why he is a publisher, not a writer. So yeah, nowadays, like, big projects especially, because I mean, they cost a fortune and they have to be distributed deeply. Distribution has to be massive, otherwise no one's going to make any money. If nobody makes any money, there's not going to be another book. So I trust the publisher, and as you well know, my publisher of choice nowadays is Vanishing Ink. Mm-hmm. Andy Gladwell, Joshua J, they care so much about books. They have always looked after me so well. I just trust them automatically with these sorts of projects. And I mean, they do beautiful books. They do beautiful books.
They do. And I don't think there's anybody in the world at the moment that's doing books as well as they are. They're just incredible.
Well, fact is, they've got it down to an art. They've got a great team. I mean, they're publishing, you know, a dozen, maybe, I don't know, 20 books a year. It's just absolutely, it's mind-boggling. And the logistics of that, it's just unbelievable.
Completely. 100%. Man, so what? That's blown away. Absolutely blown away. So, out of all of those books in the library that you're sitting in front of, which is your favorite book? For people watching this, which book would you recommend that people go and seek out first that they might not have heard of?
Well, it's one they have heard of, and that's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I mean,
well, yeah, mostly harmless, mostly harmless. Don't panic. It's a great book.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I mean, what a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece of writing, and great ideas captured with such eloquence. It keeps your imagination. That's the book that actually changed my life. Now, this is why I like printed books as opposed to e-books. You can be rummaging through somebody else's library and come across a book that may change your life. Hitchhiker's Guide, that's how I found it. Like, oh my God, I started laughing. I read it changed my life. I started reading fiction for the first time. I wasn't into reading fiction prior to that. You can't do those sort of things with ebooks. I mean, how are you going to stumble across a beautiful book if it's an ebook? What do you do? Or are you a hacker? Somebody's hard drive coming through their files? It's just not there. It's important to have physical books. I resist ebooks. However, I do have to say, but out of necessity, for instance, I mean, an ebook does allow very quick, easy, cost-effective distribution. You're not waiting for printed. And I mean, like throughout COVID, well, Symmetry and Parity, that was 18 months of production due to, you know, the delays from the COVID break problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ebooks circumnavigate that. And on the 17th of February, which is just around the corner, through Vanishing Ink, we are gifting everybody volume 2 of Symmetry and Parity, which is like an 88 page manuscript, which is the work I completed after handing the manuscript over to Andy and Josh. Nobody knew there was going to be an 18 month delay. I got bored during that 18 month delay. I wanted to start interacting and talking to people, but I couldn't. Contractually, I couldn't. So I just kept creating, and this is the result of that. Beautifully book, and the guys at Vanishing Ink, I don't know how they're going to do it, but 17th of February, Symmetry and Parity gets even better with our compliment.
Wow, that's amazing.
I'll send you the manuscript later on when we're finished.
Thank you, Ben. That's amazing. I mean, it just shows the It just shows the character of Vanishing Ink and you that, you know, you didn't have to do that. The book, the product is great on its own, but you didn't have to deliver. Wow. You know,
the thing is that this second batch of material will eventually work its way into the reprint or the second edition of the Symmetry and Parity book. But why wait a couple of years for that to happen? I mean, this material is important now because people are talking about it now. People are talking about the Svengali deck now. You've got a big Svengali deck project coming out, I believe. I mean, this year, you know, the Svengali.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
So I'm not going to hold back my material for, you know, 2 or 3 years to miss this wave, because it's exciting to ride a wave of interest in the market. I mean, it's fashion. I mean, in a couple of years, it won't be the Svengali deck, it's something else. But, you know, this is how the industry works. But
I'll go on record, Ben, as saying that Chimera, the color changing deck that you put together with the Svengali principle, is probably the best application of that principle I have ever seen, ever. Like, when I was reading through it, I didn't have the deck in hand, and I was just reading the book, and I was like, this is ridiculous. This cannot look as good as written up here. This is ridiculous. And then I took the deck, and I was like, this is insane that you can get that many color changes showing the fronts and backs of every single card multiple times. And you have so many. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
But well, you know, this harks back to that original thought. If you have a Svengali deck, which inherently has 28 identical force cards, and you throw away the 28 force cards, what's left? Boom. This is where we go. So we can do other things with it. Those force cards don't have to be all identical. Take the Parity deck, for instance. That's basically a regular deck that's been Svengali-ized, and you could do beautiful things with that. The Oil and Water in Symmetry and Parity, I think, is just my favorite piece of magic at the moment. The Symmetry and Parity workbook coming out on February the 7th as our free gift takes that a step further, with the deck actually starting out as symmetrical as I could possibly make it. And that means the blacks and the reds are in order, ace through king, ace through king. So that's your perfect example of symmetry in a deck of cards. It doesn't get any more symmetric than that. Then you start shuffling them up, boom. The symmetry just disappears before your eyes. And to then bring it back, it's lovely. And there's a nice thing in there where the package changed places now as well. I'll send you the manuscript later.
Wow. That's insane. Yeah, that's incredible. And
something in there called the Svengali deck, which is actually two Svengali decks in one. See, I know, it breaks your brain.
Wow. And I loved a couple of things I loved about the project, actually. I love the reference. I'm a big sci-fi fan, always have been. And I love the references to both Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and also Doctor Who with Case of the Tardigan. I thought presentationally, I loved that. I absolutely loved that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I was going, thinking originally of doing the Tardigan more accurately look like the Doctor's TARDIS, but we went for the pearl white with gold trim, and it looks lovely. Handmade in Malta.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then shipped to California for packaging. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why it took so long. All of these things were handmade. I mean, the Svengali deck that come with the project, the Chimera deck, the Parity deck, and the Imagination deck. It's three decks, but you can't actually just do a print run of those three decks to get the product. The US playing card company doesn't work like that. It actually involves six decks, which are then collated. It's a massive undertaking. And the interesting thing, the guys at Vanishing Ink are so cool. When I sent them the original, I sent them a mock-up of the whole thing, case, the tray, the cards, the book, everything, complete mock-up. Cost me $300 to produce the mock-up, but I wanted to impress them. I thought they'd probably say, well, yeah, Ben, that's all really fine and well, but do you think we're going to pay, throw money at all of this? I didn't think for a second they'd go for it. I thought, we'll just produce the book. Because the book actually teaches you how to make the deck of cards. Yeah, you don't need them. You don't need them. But Josh and Andy is like, man, no. We give them everything they need. Doesn't matter how much it costs. This has to be a complete kit. So, boom. Thank you. It would have been so easy to say, no. We'll save all the money and just do the book. But boom. It's their enthusiasm at Vanishing Ink. It was just absolutely brilliant. As an author, I like to see that. I mean, dealing with other publishers, the traditional publishing industry moves like a dinosaur. Seriously. It's like, yeah, a reply to, hey, where's my royalty check? You know, will take 3 months to answer. I mean, I'm talking about real world, real life publishing, not the magic industry. The enthusiasm from Vanishing Ink is just brilliant.
That's great. And it shows the faith they have in you, that because that's not going to be a cheap investment to make that book and the cards and everything. They're going to have spent a fortune on that. So it shows that the faith they have in you, in your reputation and the quality of the work that you produce, that they're prepared to put that level of investment in.
Yeah, well, most definitely. I mean, right at the beginning of the project, with the signing of the contract, that's basically what they said is like, guys, yeah, but Andy and Joshua, we have this faith in you. We're going to throw X amount of money at this. And I almost fell off my chair. It's like, gosh, you know, I hope your faith is not misplaced, because that's an awful lot of money. Point is, boom, end of the day, a few months later, massively successful product, paid for itself, everybody's happy, I'm happy, the publishers are happy, and we are happy to, boom, gift everybody with the workbook, which I think everybody's just going to love. It's a really interesting chip.
That's great. That's amazing. So one more question. What's coming up in the future? Now, you've mentioned, obviously, the very imminent arrival of Bendit Like Geller. You talked about three other books that you're bringing out, one of which is magic, two of which aren't. But outside of that, specifically with magic, is there anything else that you would like to achieve in your magical bucket list? Because let's be honest, Ben, you've achieved more than most magicians could ever dream of. You've published hundreds of tricks and books and manuscripts and ebooks, and all of them have been well received, and you have literally changed genres with some of the things that you've brought out, the Svengali deck being a perfect example. Is there anything else that you're kind of thinking, I'd like to do that? It could be as a performer or a creator or a lecturer. Is there anything you'd like to do in the future that you haven't done that's something that you'd like to do?
Well, this harks back to what we discussed before. No, I don't have any plans to explore anything in particular. I have to just wait for that inspiration to come. And it's something that's taken many, many years to learn, but it's like relationships. Youngsters nowadays, they always have done it. You go out, you're looking for a partner, you're actively looking for something, looking for that right girl, looking for that right guy. It's all very forced. You're not necessarily going to find the right person under those circumstances. People falling in love is called falling in love for a reason. It happens. It just, boom, all of a sudden, I mean, casual gaze across the room, whatever, but it happens. It's unplanned. I love magic, and for me to fall in love, something has to seduce me. Robert Neal's trapdoor card seduced me, and I spent the time with Machination. the Svengali deck, I can't actually remember why I decided to look at it, but something popped up, something piqued my interest, and it's like, man, you know, I mean, there's so much more we can do with it. And again, the first step, strip away the back, strip away the front, ask the question, do you need 26 force cards? Then go from there. The Kamaira deck that you mentioned before with all of the color changes, that begins with that blank deck and noticing all that. Well, that's where the backs would normally be, but hey, we could put more backs there. But hey, we could actually put more backs here. And so long as we keep faces here, if we're clever, we can show faces every time. So that's how it all starts, stripping it right back. One of my bucket lists, I'm not through with levitation yet. I think there's something out there clever yet to be discovered, an application or something that will create a very beautiful levitation, because I think that levitation is possibly the strongest or one of the strongest magical effects we can perform, because there's no counting, there's no remembering. It's just you or the object defying the laws of physics. No explanation required. So it's so easy to feel the wonder, because you don't actually have to think about it. Inherently, you know it can't be, but it is. Boom. So yeah, levitation is levitation is seducing me. There's something else there. I don't know what it is yet. I don't care what it is yet, because when the time comes, like the in regards to Cosmosis, like documentary on the bridge architecture, when the time comes, I will notice something. It's like, boom, that's what I needed. As a creator, it is so important to be constantly aware of everything that's around you and any strange applications you can think of. With the old trick, the epic flight, with the marking pens and the oil marker, permanent marker, and the whiteboard marker. The permanent marker won't come off. You can't rub it off. But nobody had noticed prior. If you then go over it with the whiteboard marker to reinforce it, supposedly, now the whole thing has dissolved and it will just wipe off. That came out of simply observing that one day by picking up the wrong pen. It's like, dude, if we can convince everybody that that mark ain't going anywhere, make it a little bit bigger so you can all see, having done the dirty work, we can create transpositions or whatever. And I used to use a little Doctor Who presentation with that as well. Back in the mid-1980s, I toured a big lecture tour featuring that trick and the floating match.
Wow. And I mean, I have one other question, which is... Yeah,
you've had one other question all morning.
No, but I keep thinking of stuff to ask you. Yeah. How often do I get a chance to do this? You've had so many manuscripts come out. You showed X-ray earlier on, and we've talked about many, many of those. I mean, so many, too many to count. A lot of them are now out of print. You can't get them anywhere, really, as manuscripts. Have you ever considered taking some of your more popular manuscripts and re-releasing them, or maybe doing a book with the collected works of Ben Harris and taking all of these individual things and putting them into a book? Is that something that maybe you might look at?
Well, firstly, pretty much my entire back catalogue is available in ebook format from library.com, Chris Washuba. Lovely guy. He owns the rights to all the older material in electronic digital format. And yes, there are plans afoot for the big book of Ben. It's not going to be called that, but that's just the working title. That's how I keep myself amused, all right? As simple as that. So when anybody asks you, when anybody says, hey, how's the book coming? Meaning the big book, you mean the big book of Ben? And roll around laughing. But yes, it is happening. I don't want to write it myself. I just don't want to write it myself. I think that's too self-indulgent. I mean, somebody else needs to just have a cold, hard look, get rid of what doesn't deserve to be there, highlight what does deserve to be there, and put it together. I love seeing a manuscript come back from from an editor. It's a good editor really makes you more lucid. And Steve Shuffman's my editor with Magic Books, and he does a great job. And I have editors in the other fields as well. And to receive your edited manuscript back, it's like you putting the manuscript aside for 6 months and coming back, but without having to wait for that 6 month period.
Yeah. Wow. So
probably rambling on about a little bit.
No, I'm excited. I now know about the Big Book of Ben. I'm very excited. But if you know, obviously, not counting Symmetry and Parity,
yep.
And not counting Bend It Geller
or Beckham,
Beckham even. If people,
well, it's interesting. Uri's a really, really big football fan, and you've got to be very careful about using somebody's name on the front cover of a book that's about them, especially. So I bounced that off him. I said, hey, it was important to have Geller on the front there somehow. He didn't want an image on there because that's him being too close. You know, he's still playing, you know, straight down the line. Okay, he can't be too close. It's still proclaimed psychic versus skeptic. It's just not nasty anymore, and it doesn't have to be nasty. Okay, we have a beautiful effect whether it's psychic or not, doesn't matter, and we've all sort of agreed that's the case. It doesn't matter. What we have are the repercussions of the controversy, those repercussions, that noise that has remained 50 years later of the controversy. That gives us our background, I think, in which to perform metal bending with relevance today. Thus, all the deep presentations not required to the extent it used to be. So I bounced that off Uri. So, hey, well, bend it like Beckham, bend it like Geller. What do you think? And he loved it, which is just good. Uri is positive about this book, even though it's a skeptic versus psychic book. It's a lovely book. And as Uri says, this is show business. Just make sure you spell my name correctly.
That's right. Great advice. Absolutely right. But yeah, if people wanted to go back and look at your earlier work on library.com, which is a fantastic resource, you're correct. And they were looking through and they want to get one manuscript to get an idea of your work.
Yep.
What one thing would you suggest that they pick up from library.com?
Oh, gosh, that is a difficult one. Probably Crossroads. Because Crossroads is something I'm really proud of. I think that's a very, very clever a solution to the problem of pretty much producing a name card from your pocket or from your shoe or from under your hat. Or whatever. And it has a lot of applications. I personally still think it's very clever, and I like clever things. We all like clever things. So long as the clever bit's not the main bit, you know what I'm saying? You've got your effect and your presentation. If the method happens to be clever, that's just like a little extra bonus. It's a private little chuckle we have to ourselves. But yeah, Crossroads. For sure, I think.
Crossroads was excellent.
And X-Ray.
Well, like I said at the very beginning of the interview, and if people haven't seen my review of X-Ray back in 2010, when me and David Penn were running the Wizard product review together, go back and watch it because, it made such an impact on me. I had never been so fooled at that point as I was. I seem to remember just completely losing it on camera and not having a clue. It was, which delighted Dave no end, but it's, It's a magician fooler. I mean, it's something like all of your material. It works for real people 100%. But it's one of those tricks that you can pull out at a magic convention sitting around with your magic buddies that will just completely blow them away.
Yeah. And even though I established the parameters of the plot for X-Ray myself, it was my good buddy and editor, Steve Shupton, who actually came up with the very, very elegant solution. So on you, Steve. Thank you, my friend.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Ben, you have done so much for the magic community. You have written so much. You have produced so much. And you're a shining light. You really are. I've said to you, for people that are watching this, I remember contacting Ben about 2 years ago when I first started Magic TV. And I said, I'm doing interviews. I'd love to have you on the channel. And you were like, yeah, let's leave it until the book comes out. And I'd love to do an interview. 2 years later, pretty much, we finally got to that point. I've been wanting you on the channel since then, and I'm so glad that I've had you on here doing an interview. Thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate it.
My friend, it has been an absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Well, this platform is yours to use. If you ever want to promote anything, whether it be a new book or a new project or anything at all, I'm at your disposal because, you know,
I think that's just lovely. Thank you, my friend. That's beautiful. And I think when Bended Like Geller comes out and you have a copy in your hands, we should talk again because it's a very important book.
I'd like that.
It's an important book. It doesn't matter who wrote it. I happen to have written it, but that doesn't matter. It's an important book no matter who wrote it. Because for the first time ever, we have the entire story. And it presents an evolutionary path that wasn't obvious before. It wasn't obvious until I sat down and got the material. It's like, oh my God, A leads B leads C leads D. It's just absolutely amazing. I mean, the first metal bending gimmick was invented by Ali Bongo, who happened to be seated in the front or in the audience of the David Dimbleby talking show during Geller's breakout performance. I mean, little bits of information like that are just like, boom.
Wow.
Yeah, it's...
Very well. I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, the Bongo Bender was the product, and it was soon followed by the Xanadu Bender and other products, which now, of course, have led through evolution to the variety of coin bending gimmicks, etc., that we have today. Mr. Wow. Ali Bongo, the Shriek of Araby.
We've got a lot to thank Ali Bongo for as well. We really have.
We do.
We stand on the shoulders of giants, right, Ben?
For sure, mate. Yep.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's fantastic.
We need to wear comfortable shoes.
100%. And I would be delighted. I would be delighted to have you back on the channel when Bend It Like Geller comes out, because I'd love to.
We shall do that.
Wonderful. I'd love to do a deep dive into that and find out more. Of course, I bet there's
some great stories in there. I mean, for instance, I'll just give you a snippet. It was pulled off the presses in China due to a censorship issue. We're talking about spoon bending. We'll talk about that next time when we do a proper interview. But I mean, the little stories are just incredible.
That's amazing. I cannot wait. I genuinely can't. Ben, if people want to connect with you, what's the best way to do that? If they want to reach out to you, is it email? Is it a website? Is it social media? Is there a way that people can reach out to you?
Yep, just go to the website, which is wowbound.com. And basically you click through, you come up my link tree, and there are all of the products that are available, signed copies of books. And the social media links, YouTube videos, if you want to go and have a look at some of the symmetry and parody stuff, I've got a YouTube channel devoted just to that. And shortly you'll be able to download for free the symmetry and parody workbook once Vanishing have released that February 17th. Gonna sound like a walking advertisement.
February the 17th coincides with the start of the Blackpool Magic Convention. So maybe
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? That hadn't dawned on me. Yeah.
Seventeenth of February is the first day of the world's largest magic convention this year.
There you go. So nobody will notice little old me.
Well, I have a feeling
we'll have a bend it like Geller, release that there. But it may be a little bit too soon. But we'll see. Because I can't wait. It's a big picture book, and your neck's tacked on. You need to have it.
Yeah, I can't wait. And the second I get it in my hands, I will arrange another interview. Ben,
please, that'd be fun.
Thank you so much. I want everyone to connect with Ben Harris and also leave a comment down below. I'm sure Ben will read it. Let him know what you thought of the interview. I'm genuinely honored to have a legend like you on the channel. So Ben, one more time, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Petty. Stay well.
Absolutely. Guys, leave a comment down below. I'll be back again with another video. And look out, because Ben will be back very, very soon talking about Bend It Like Geller. Go and buy all of his stuff. Go and check out his website and go and get his new book. It's incredible. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you, man. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV. Or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.